You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 16th of May 2022 on Monocle 24. Is Russia really going to lose the war in Ukraine? Lebanon is weary of politics and its politicians. Will an election bring change? And can North Korea handle a COVID pandemic? I'm Emma Nelson. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to The Monocle Daily, coming to you live from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Emma Nelson. And what would a Russian defeat in Ukraine look like? As NATO's Secretary General says Ukraine could win the conflict, we'll examine what could happen if Putin's great gamble fails. Also to come, where are Lebanese politics heading as Hezbollah looks at a defeat in the country's parliamentary elections? Plus, we'll be at Photo London. All that and more coming up right here on The Monocle Daily. And a very warm welcome to you. I'm joined today by Baria Alamuddin, international journalist and broadcaster, and by the former British ambassador, John Everard. Welcome both. How are you?
Thank you. Oh, jolly good. I'm enjoying the weather, quite busy, just published a book on the militias in Iraq.
OK, I'm going to bite. Tell us about the book, Barry.
Well, this is, it's quite appropriate to talk about it because we're going to talk about the Lebanese elections. So these are very close brothers of Hezbollah in Lebanon, and they were trained actually by Hezbollah. They're proxies of Iran in the area, and they do the biddings of Iran exactly like Hezbollah does in Lebanon. And they're being very naughty now indeed, and they've always been terrible for the country. They took over the country. That's why I called the book Militia State, and they are not allowing the country after elections, which they lost very badly, like I hope Hezbollah will end up doing in Lebanon. They're not allowing them to form a government or to have a president. So that's my book.
Thank you for that, Barry. We will be heading to deal with Lebanon a little bit later on today's show. John, how are you? Any books out?
No books recently. I haven't had time, I'm afraid. I mean, my life was chugging along perfectly happily until 24 February when that nice man Vladimir Putin decided to turn it upside down. As you know, I'm a former ambassador to Belarus, and Belarus is deep in this conflict, and my phone simply hasn't stopped ringing since. I've been trying to explain to everybody what part Belarus is playing or not playing, why Lukashenko's doing what he's doing, and why there are no longer any Russian troops in Belarus. It's all quite complex, but I do wish the war would end, just for that and many other good reasons.
We will be calling upon your authority on Belarus in a little while in the programme, but first, let's head to Buffalo. More details are emerging about the gunman who killed 10 people and injured 3 others in a shooting in Buffalo. Authorities say they're investigating it as a racially motivated hate crime. Well, a little while ago, I heard from Bob McCarthy, who's a veteran political reporter at the Buffalo News, and I began by asking him for the latest.
Emma, at this point, I think we know pretty much all we need to know is that an 18-year-old fellow from the Binghamton area in New York State, about 3.5 hours away, came up here on Saturday with the express intent to kill Black people. He was dressed in army fatigues, and as we find out later, including bulletproof vest. He had an advanced rifle. I'm not sure whether it was automatic or semi-automatic, but he came in to the Tops supermarket on Jefferson Avenue in a primarily Black neighborhood at about 2:30 on Saturday and began shooting people in the parking lot. He then went inside, killed a retired Buffalo police lieutenant who was working security at the market, and then continued on through the store shooting more people. In just a few minutes, 10 people were dead, 3 were injured, and it only took maybe 2 or 3 minutes for police officers from the Buffalo Police Department to arrive at the parking lot where he was standing with a gun under his chin. They talked him down and immediately subdued him. Since then, he's been charged, he's been jailed, and this community is reeling. And that's why President Biden is coming here tomorrow. That's basically where we are right now.
Tell us about how the community is reacting to this. There's been a vigil, but this is an indescribable trauma for you.
It is. I have to tell you that people are just in shock. I mean, you're talking about a beautiful springtime Saturday afternoon, and everybody's out enjoying the world. And the next thing is that this pall comes over the city and the whole country. And this city is absolutely in shock. I mean, you hear about these things, and this is almost a cliche, Emma, but you hear about these things happening in other places, and it doesn't happen here, but it did. And to think that it was racially motivated makes it even more difficult to comprehend, let alone accept. And so I think that's really what is part of the pall that's hanging over the city of Buffalo today.
The New York governor has promised action on hate speech that she says spreads like a virus. What needs to be done here, Bob?
Well, I don't know. And it's a difficult problem that she will address, because what we call First Amendment rights here, which is the right of free speech, is something that is always something that you have to keep in mind when you talk about limiting that. So what Governor Hochul has in mind, I don't know, but it certainly has risen to the top of the discussion in this country throughout the weekend as a result of this. And you know, this one, I think, is different from people who indiscriminately go in and start shooting. This one is clearly racially motivated, and it's been documented by some of the things that this kid from Broome County wrote in the days before, and that's what makes you know, free speech is pretty difficult when you talk about hate speech, and it's a difficult issue. I don't know what the plans are going to be, but I'll tell you one thing is that it's certainly one of the main topics throughout this whole country today.
One of the approaches, though, might be a little bit different from had this happened a few years ago. Arguably under Donald Trump's presidency, the reaction to what happened where you are would have been, dare I say it, a semi-legitimized white supremacist narrative. We now have Joe Biden in charge. How does that change things?
Well, there's no question that Joe Biden has embraced this incident and severely criticized it in remarks that he made on Sunday. And he is coming here tomorrow. He will meet with all the local officials, including the mayor and the county executive and the district attorney. And I expect that the governor also, and the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, will come up from Washington with him on Air Force One. And I'm sure that he will address this in terms of seeking stronger gun control. And I what he will say about hate speech and that kind of thing on the internet, I'm not sure, except that he will take it on. And that could be a different kind of thing, especially with gun control, than what President Trump.
That was Bob McCarthy from the Buffalo News there talking to me earlier. Barry, just listening to that, he said that there was a city in shock. And it sounded really strongly in his voice that he was not quite believing what he was talking about.
Yeah, I think the whole world is in shock, isn't it? And funny you should mention Donald Trump. This is exactly where my thoughts went. And I remember when he stood there and said there are good people on both sides, including the far right supremacy. I think, in the world, don't stop sometimes to think about these things, and we start to accept them as daily routine life. I have family living in the States. I have grandchildren living in the States. And I tell you, this worries me a lot, this attitude of hate. And it's plain and clear. I was in the States 10 days ago. I visited New York and Washington. And the main problem people had is the fear of Trump might coming back, and what this will do to embolden people like this the guy who just did this horrendous murders. So it's sad, and it's where the world should not be, especially in a country like the States, where people think of the American dream, and where you want to go and enjoy democracy. This is against human rights, democracy, peace, whatever you want to say.
And John, we have this incredibly difficult balance that the New York Governor Hochul is trying to sort out at the moment, which is a decision to clamp down on hate speech. But as Bob McCarthy from the Buffalo News just said, you cannot silence free speech either. That's a fundamental.
Absolutely. There is no good answer to this. One person's hate speech is another person's free speech. And if you clamp down on hate speech because you disapprove of it so profoundly, what do you do with the inevitable clamour after that from people who disapprove of other things, perhaps equally profoundly? You are on a very slippery slope. Of course, you know, we have to do everything possible to prevent these kind of things happening. We don't yet know how far the access to hate speech motivated this man, but if it is shown that he would not have killed these people had this hate speech not taken place, then I think those defending free speech are on a very difficult position.
Social media is particularly dangerous here. And I do agree with you, first, because I'm a journalist. And of course, free speech is very important and fundamental in my life and my career. But if this is what free speech does to us, then we should think about it twice. Yeah.
You're listening to The Monocle Daily with me, Emma Nelson. It's 1811 here in London. Now, the plan was for the tanks to roll across the border on the 24th of February and for Ukraine to roll over in immediate defeat for Russia. But few, including Vladimir Putin himself, accurately estimated just how hard Ukraine could fight. Now the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has gone as far as to say that Ukraine could win this conflict. John, let me begin with you. What does a defeat look like for Russia?
There are grades of defeat. I mean, complete defeat would be the total eviction of all the Russian forces from all the territory of Ukraine as constituted before 2014. That would be a political shock to the Russian system that, frankly, Putin's government would be most unlikely to survive. But equally, being forced back to the lines of 2014, the Ukrainians holding on to the parts of Donbass that they still control, perhaps eating back even into bits of Crimea. Even if Russia maintains a toehold on Ukraine, a stalemate would effectively be a defeat. This, as you said, Emma, was supposed to be a roll of a victory. Anything short of a control of Ukraine, or at least of the vital southern seaboard now, is a defeat for Vladimir Putin.
And that's an assumption that things will go logically. But we have, Barrier, in the case of a Russian defeat, a wounded beast in Vladimir Putin.
That's the danger. And many people, I attended two of the record meetings this weekend on Russia and Ukraine. And everybody said, people who know Putin, have worked with him, they say Putin does not negotiate. Putin does not listen. Putin only listens to himself. And as you rightly categorized it as a beast, he's really a beast. I think it will be very clever of the West, especially in the case of defeat, and I do hope he will be defeated indeed, is to allow him some kind of a let go. Because also I do not think that Putin is about to go peacefully, or Putin is about to, I do not buy that he's going to use nuclear weapons, because he loves himself too much and he's not stupid. He's quite a clever man, and he knows it will be not only the end of Europe or millions of people in the state, but also the end of himself and his people. However, this is a very, very interesting subject. And also, let's not forget that Ukraine has said they are going to arm 1 million people. And Ukraine, thanks to NATO and thanks to the Americans, are using the latest technological arms that exists in the world, while Putin is still using very old. And also, his soldiers are not motivated. So it's interesting, the dynamics with Ukraine being the small country compared to Russia and the small army, and with Russia.
And we have, don't we, this observation that Barry has meant that we have arguably overestimated Russia as much as we underestimated Ukraine.
Yes, that's right. And I think we're now in danger of underestimating Russian military power. There is a lot of fighting still to come. There's still a great deal to fight for. And the fighting in Donbass, which is of a much more open territory, favours the Russians much more than did the attempt to take out Kiev. But yes, what happens next? I don't see how we can continue to deal with Russia with Putin at the helm. When Joe Biden said a few weeks ago that this man must not stay in power, that remark famously was not in his script, but neither was that impromptu. He had thought hard before saying something so inflammatory, and he was signalling to the other oligarchs in Russia that if Putin goes, then maybe we can sit down and do some kind of deal. With Putin there, there's absolutely no way. Putin right now must be feeling very, very worried, not just with what's happening on the battlefield, but what's happening in international politics. And, of course, as we learn, he's also very sick. Talk of blood cancer. The Americans at the start of all this said that they believed that Putin thought he had a limited window to take over Ukraine. Now, at that point, most observers thought they meant a limited political window. It may be that, in fact, they knew more than we did at that point and are saying that he only has a certain time to keep going in reasonable health, and he has to act now.
And the rest of the world, how does it deal with Russia were this victory by Ukraine to occur? Because we have lessons learned from lack of action in 2014. The world should have acted then. We have loud calls for regime change occurring from, and louder calls coming from inside Russia. But also, we will have to try to impose some sort of retribution, the investigation of war crimes. This is something that takes years to go through, doesn't it, Barry?
Absolutely. And I want to say something about Putin's stay. And he might go, and he has cancer or whatever. We've been hearing a lot about that. I remember talking about Assad in the same way, that Assad cannot survive and Assad will not survive and he will be gone today and tomorrow. So I would take this with a pinch of salt. I don't know. I do hope Biden, of course, is right. I think the way we deal with Putin, and the whole world is watching, indeed the Chinese, indeed the North Korean, indeed Iran, I think we should stop this impunity that we give regimes like Putin's regime. Otherwise, the world is going to face much more important crises, wars. This is we live in a world that has become seriously dangerous and unstable. People are almost nervous around Europe and around the world. So we need leadership in the world. We need strategy to deal with people like Putin. I firmly believe that if we have dealt with Putin in a different way and not had allowed him to do what he did in Chechnya or Georgia or Crimea, and indeed in Syria as well, then we wouldn't have reached this stage where we are in today.
Let's move on to another issue of leadership and strategy in another part of the world. The final numbers are yet to be confirmed, but as we go to air, voters in Lebanon appear to have turned their backs on Hezbollah and its allies. A Christian group named the Lebanese Forces Party appears to have made gains in the first parliamentary elections since the country went into economic meltdown in 2019 and a huge explosion ripped through the port of Beirut a year later. Barry, I'm well aware you're very keen to talk about this. Could you explain just a bit of background, just to bring us up to speed, please?
Sure. Since almost 40 years, since the 1982, Iran, Qasem Soleimani in particular, developed this group called Hezbollah, and they convinced everybody, including me, that these people are actually going to save us from Israeli aggression, which happened frequently in Lebanon, still does. And these people became so strong, and they have taken part in wars in Syria, in Yemen, and indeed everywhere. And they deal with Captagon, they deal with money laundering. They're a very dangerous group of people. And that's why the Lebanese suddenly woke up to themselves to find out that all the lies of telling them that here we are, a group, Hezbollah, trying to protect you against Daesh or against Israel or whatever, is a complete huge lie. And what Hezbollah does is the bidding of Iran in the area and is being used by Iran. So the actual problem in Lebanon now is also poverty, is also the currency losing its value almost 90%. Nevertheless, we see that people wanted their independence. They wanted to gain again that independence from Hezbollah and from Iran. And that's why you see this group called Al-Quwat al-Lubnaniya, or the Lebanese forces, gaining ground as much, because they came to the elections and told people, we want to bring back Lebanon to the Arab fold where it belongs, and we want to regain our independence from Iran. So really, basically, this is about the sovereignty and the independence on Lebanon. Strangely, although people are very poor, they cannot find medicine, yet they stuck to this theme mostly.
How much faith or hope do the Lebanese electorate actually have that any change will come? I mean, they are weary from economic meltdown. They are weary from political infighting and graft. They are weary from the fact that economically their country is on its knees. Their capital was blown to smithereens 2 years ago. The low turnout, was it 41% of the electorate came out? I mean, where do they look for hope in here?
Yes. Well, actually, they're now depending on themselves, because also the whole world, especially the Arab world that always came to their aid, told them as long as you'd because Hezbollah has been attacking the Arab world, the Gulf countries, etc. As long as you are not regaining your independence, we can't do anything for you. And indeed, the World Bank as well. But the problem in Lebanon now has just started, because Hezbollah could create they can start killing people, they can start a war with Israel, they can do so much damage to the security inside the country, apart from the damage they have created to what Lebanon's image is in the world. Now, people think of us more as Hezbollah, as Captagon country, sending it around the world, and indeed to our neighbors. So the problem in a way just started. Also, there could be a parallel with Iraq, where Hezbollah will not allow whoever wins to form a government, and we need also to elect a new president.
Where does the rest of the international community come in here, John? Because clearly there is a lot of goodwill for Lebanon to succeed for so many different reasons: security, economic, social. But they can't step in, or can they?
But they could, but I don't think they want to. I mean, I think it's very important that Lebanese find solutions to Lebanese problems. I think the best thing that the international community can do at this stage is to exert whatever influence you can on Iran, certainly, but also on Saudi Arabia, to let the Lebanese... I'm getting funny looks across the table.
No, it's because I really wish, in a way, that Saudi Arabia is interfering. Saudi Arabia doesn't have a militia in Lebanon. You see?
No, I understand that. But I do fear that if Saudi Arabia did interfere, then Iran would feel morally entitled to come back. I think the best thing is that everybody just leaves Lebanon to sort out its own problems, which are huge. I mean, you talked about the economy just now. Even if you leave aside the inevitable factional infighting that's going to happen now, the results that are just coming out of these elections are a recipe for political paralysis. At a time when Lebanon desperately needs leadership, somebody to grip the economic situation and to try to turn the country around.
You know, our problem is that the Lebanese, since quite a few years now, are asking the Arab countries, specifically Saudi Arabia, to show interest in Lebanon. For months, we didn't have even an ambassador. All the Gulf countries withdrew their ambassadors. So what we need is more interest from the Gulf countries in Lebanon. The last 4 or 5 years or more even, these Arab countries felt so disgusted with what Hezbollah is doing in Syria, what Hezbollah is doing in Iraq, in Yemen. I'm sure they're aware of their role in Yemen, for example, and what it's doing. thing. So they just said, hell with Lebanon. We don't want to come to Lebanon. We don't want to deal with Lebanon. So what we need right now is more of a balance. Iran controls, Hezbollah controls peace and war. It controls every aspect of the government. And that's why my book on Iraq, I called it Militia State, because Iraq is effectively a militia state. So is Lebanon.
Let's move on. Meanwhile, the US President Joe Biden is traveling to Asia in the first visit to the region in his presidency. It comes as North Korea faces a major coronavirus outbreak. For more, let's hear from Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson.
US President Joe Biden arrives in Asia later this week, his first visit to the region since taking office. Biden will be meeting the new South Korean president, Yoon Suk-yeol, in Seoul, and consolidating his commitment to an open Indo-Pacific at a meeting with his Quad allies from India, Japan and Australia in Tokyo. Mending Japan-South Korea ties is high on the agenda as North Korea's missile and nuclear program develops. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is currently managing a COVID outbreak in his unvaccinated country. The state's official Korean Central News Agency reported nearly 400,000 new fever cases in a 24-hour period on Sunday. The Japanese government has yet to make an official comment about whether it will be offering assistance, but President Yoon has reiterated his country's willingness to help with medical supplies. I have been repeatedly saying that I'll always be open to humanitarian aid, regardless of political or military issues that lie between South and North Korea. If the offer comes with conditions, Kim is unlikely to welcome it.
That was Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson. Joining me in the studio, Barrier Alamuddin and John Everard. John, we move into your area of expertise here as former ambassador to Pyongyang. What can you imagine is happening in North Korea at the moment? Because for the first time, the North Koreans have accepted that they have a problem with COVID.
Yes, that's right. And a big problem, a huge problem. 1.2 million cases announced in the most recent bulletin. That's up from about 300,000 on Thursday. So the case rate has quadrupled over 4 days. This is consistent with the R-naught of the Omicron virus and ripping through a completely unvaccinated population like a fire through a prairie. Virologists find it very difficult to predict how is going to play in North Korea. After all, they found it difficult in the United States. North Korea's course is much more difficult. But opinions tend to cluster around two conclusions. Firstly, that it's going to spread right through the entire country very quickly. It's already in all the major cities, as North Korean Evening News was showing last night. Two, that the case fatality rate, that's to say the percentage of people who will die, who will catch the disease and die, is about 2%, which is terrifying. That translates into hundreds of thousands of deaths. This means that the humanitarian catastrophe that is about to sweep through North Korea is up there with the starvation of the 1990s, of the Great Famine. It is a cataclysm, and there is nothing that anybody can do about it. We talk about vaccines. It's far too late to get vaccines in now. Even if sufficient vaccine could be found with the needles, with the people to administer them, every day that goes past means that the virus spreads that much faster. You could help more by getting in drugs to treat people who are seriously ill with it. But then you have storage problems in North Korea. You have distribution problems. Essentially, this is going to rage. Hundreds of thousands of people are going to die. And there's a real risk not only that you have a humanitarian disaster, but a political implosion. North Koreans have heard their leader promise that he can keep the virus at bay by locking the country down. He doesn't need vaccines. And they can now see with their own eyes what is happening. This could be the end.
Barry, this is absolutely shocking stuff. We have the South Korean president offering assistance, saying he's open to humanitarian aid no matter what the political differences are. But the world is are we, how stuck are we in terms of just looking at what John has warned is going to happen?
Yeah. Emma, I'm going to use my time actually to ask John a question, if you don't mind.
Feel free.
I think it's horrific, and I think what the South Korean president is offering is great and humanitarian, and this is the right way to go. Don't forget, these are almost the same people. One is called North, one is called South. How would this pandemic affect the leadership of the country? I mean, the president and his cronies. Would this undermine him in any way?
Completely.
Because that would be...
Completely.
Would, but the, you can't get rid of him, can you?
Why not?
How?
Because the way the Koreans...
They are brutal.
Yes, of course. Mm. But, I mean, you have to remember, people tend to imagine that North Korea is a well-organized society with counter-terrorism. Remember, last time the regime blundered in 2009, where they tried to suppress markets, there were riots. People were on the streets. And the security forces were forced back into their barracks. In the end, the government had to find a scapegoat and shoot him and say, he made a mistake and go back to where we were. I think the same is quite likely this time. I think the lockdown will become very difficult to enforce. I think you are quite likely to have angry people roaming the streets looking for food. You cannot be sure of the loyalty of your security forces. I think it could just go bang.
But just explain to that a little bit further, because in the conversations previously that we've had about North Korea, you have an unhappy but biddable population. But this you think is enough because we have... We have arguably a highly undernourished population we're talking about here. They are not a healthy nation going into a pandemic, nor do they have the health infrastructure that is needed to cope with deaths. But you are saying that actually this is the moment that could get rid of the authorities, that you could get rid of Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, yes, I mean... I don't know whether it will be. It certainly could be. There will be widespread public anger. People are fed up with being hungry. Remember, Kim Jong-un admitted 2 years ago that the country faced unprecedented challenges. It was a very, very difficult time. The economy has tanked because of the isolation. The Food and Agriculture Organization points to continued food shortages. North Korea, on top of all this, is going through the second worst drought in 40 years. The harvest is going to fail again this year. I think the pressures on the regime are now intense.
Where will they take help from, though? I mean, China could arguably help, but China is dealing with its own zero COVID policy, which is causing all manner of problems for them.
Yes, China has said it will help. China has said it will stand by North Korea and give it all the vaccines
but
it wants.
The vaccine doesn't work.
The vaccine, yes, there are question marks over China's vaccines, that's true. Also, there will be terrible logistic problems getting sufficient vaccines in quickly enough. And as I say, I think we're simply too late. And in any case, tellingly, North Korea remains North Korea. Kim Jong-un's regime has refused to accept vaccines from anyone, even with all this happening. That to them, still now, the political hit from admitting in public that they got this so badly wrong is worse than the prospect of more of their people dying.
John Everard, we'll have to leave it there. And thanks also to Barrier Alameddin, my two guests. Thank you so much for coming into the studio. It's good to see you. Finally, on today's programme, this weekend saw the latest edition of Photo London, a major photography fair held in the capital every May. On display was photography from Ukraine to Gabon to the United States, some vintage and some contemporary and experimental. Photo London also highlights the emerging talent and exciting new trends we can spot in photography. And Monocle's Lillian Fawcett went to find out more.
Photo London's founders want it to be an antidote to the usual art fair experience. Instead of organising the event in a tent, they wanted to do it in a palace, which is why they've held it at London's Somerset House every year since its relaunch in 2015. Michael Benson and Fariba Fashad are the fair's founding directors.
Photo London is one of the world's great photography fairs, one of the two great photography fairs in the world. We have 108 galleries from 18 countries worldwide showing this year. We also have two fantastic exhibitions, one by our master of photography, Nick Knight, and one by Frank Horvath.
How do you go about choosing the exhibitors and curating this huge exhibition? Where do you even begin with something like that?
Well, we begin about the day after the fair closes, because our aim is to have the very best group of exhibitors we possibly can, which is why we have a curatorial committee. And we spend quite a lot of time talking to galleries, asking them what they're planning to bring, seeing whether that'll work in London. There's a particular issue about whether photography, people are bringing works in London. So it's a year-long process. By January of next year, we will have the group of galleries, and it will be a surprise to us. We will, the nice thing about the fair is we go away at the end of the fair and think, so what next?
And it's obviously important for you to have a very international exhibition as well, isn't it?
This year, for example, we got 106 galleries from 18 countries, and it's always been, this is our seventh edition, in London and always been very much international, American and French specifically been present. And obviously this year, from, you know, even after 2 years of pandemic, you have variation of countries, like from South America to
Iran.
The discovery section of Photo London presents some of what's happening at the kind of frontiers of photography. What's on offer there this year, and what kind of new exciting innovations are we seeing in photography? What are some of the emerging themes there?
One of the themes is this business of the boundary, crossing the boundaries between photography and other art forms, in particular this year in discovery, sculpture. So there's quite a lot of galleries which are presenting sculptures as well as photography. So that's an important theme. There's a lot of experimentation based on previous, or sort of, if you like, old techniques of photography. So there's galleries like Equinom who present work that is by artists who are using techniques which have been around since the dawn of the medium.
One of the fair's main exhibitions this year is a collection by groundbreaking fashion photographer Frank Horvat, curated by his daughter Fia Mena.
Your listener might not know that he passed away not very long time ago, so it's beautiful to have a first homage, particularly in London, because he had a long relationship with this town. And I'm also very grateful because fashion photography is still struggling to define itself as photography. So it's quite brave, which is amazing, but it is quite brave in a photo fair to celebrate fashion photography. And it's beautiful, and we decided to show the fashion side and also a much more intimate side, which is the nightlife in Paris in the 50s.
Fia Mena points out that while the images look classical, at the time they were revolutionary. Frank was known for getting models out of the studio and into unstaged outdoor settings. One image for Vogue in 1961 shows a woman in a three-piece tweed suit on a cobbled street in Yorkshire, surrounded by smiling children. In another, a bride rides the Paris tram, veil and all.
It's actually quite technical, because you have to imagine that at the time, fashion photography was done in studios with quite heavy equipment, with lighting and everything. And even physically, the girls would have tons of makeup, wigs, eyelashes. I mean, the whole thing was quite artificial, however beautiful. I think he really came with that need to explore the inside, that he was very much into introspection all his life. And I think he even came into fashion with this idea that you have to show the true woman, which seems to us crazy when you see the image, because they look so classical. But actually, it was really important. So he would remove the makeup famously. He would sometimes make them cry, because those women, they felt very vulnerable without their eyelashes. And he would bring them outside.
Photo London's coveted Master of Photography Award this year went to Nick Knight, whose work explores different mediums. Here's co-founder Fariba again on what Nick Knight and Frank Horvat have in common.
Both in different era, they were, and he is, Nick Knight, breaking the boundaries and, you know, changing the face of, you know, photography, or the perception of fashion photography, and in their own area making a major revolution almost. And a lot of artists here are following and experimenting, and that's beautiful to capture.
And that was Fariba Farshad there, ending that report from Photo London by Lillian Fawcett. Well, that's all we have time for today's edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to my panellists today, Barrier Alamuddin and John Everard. Today's show is produced by Chris Chermak and research by Lillian Fawcett. Our sound engineer was Callum McLean. I'm Emma Nelson, and the Monocle Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. For now, though, from me, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.